From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, the left remains worked up over the recent draft report by the Commission on Unalienable Rights. The commission was formed last year by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as what he had seen and experienced since becoming the 70th United States Secretary of State suggested it was time for an informed review of the role of human rights in our foreign policy, so that our foreign policy will serve American interest and reflect American values. One of the major criticisms of the report is the prioritization of religious freedom as a foreign policy priority. And yet, because the Trump administration has made religious freedom the top foreign policy objective in this administration, the result has been men, women, and children are experiencing freedom, not just religious freedom, but political freedoms as well. Now, you might be tempted to ask, why is promoting religious freedom in our foreign policy important? Why should we care? First, as Christians, we not only recognize, but also we must defend the right of every person to choose to follow God or not. Of course, we want them to choose to follow God, and we want the freedom to encourage him to make that choice. But from a public policy standpoint, there is a growing body of research that reveals that when religious freedom is present, there is greater economic freedom and greater social stability, which ultimately means less of a national security issue for the U.S. Now, case in point is the African country of Sudan. After more than 75 years of colonial rule by Britain and others, Sudan became an independent country back in 1956. Now, at the time, northern Sudan was predominantly Muslim, and southern Sudan was steeped in African cultural traditions as well as some Christian influence. When leaders wanted to unify the nation by forcefully applying Islamic laws and culture onto the entire country, a civil war between the northern leaders seeking this unification and those who were opposed to it, mostly in the south, resulted in a war that lasted from 1955 to 1972. Now, following a short-lived agreement that unified the three southern Sudanese provinces and allowed them autonomy, hostilities then resumed again in 1983. The Muslim Brotherhood exerted greater influence, increasing the presence of Sharia law. Plagued by political, economic, and social instability, the government was overthrown by a Revolutionary Command Council for National Salvation led by Lieutenant General Omar al-Bashir, resulting in Sudan being under a harsh and punitive Islamist government for the last three decades. But all of that changed a little over a year ago. And while far from being a bastion of freedom, the country of 41 million people is experiencing historic changes, changes that include religious and political freedom. Now, my first encounter with the leadership of Sudan was in 2014 when I became involved in the case of Maryam Ibrahim, a young Sudanese mother who was convicted of apostasy and then sentenced to die. Maryam was imprisoned in Khartoum along with her 18-month-old son. She was also pregnant with her second child at the time, which she would eventually give birth to in the prison while chained to the floor. International outcry and effective advocacy of several, including those who will join us today, led to her freedom. Now, under the new Sudanese transitional government led by Prime Minister Hamdok, whom I met with in Sudan earlier this year, they just repealed that apostasy law, a major development in the pursuit of religious freedom for the Sudanese people. Maryam Ibrahim will join us later to reflect on this monumental change. Also, a champion for Maryam and for the persecuted everywhere, former Virginia Congressman Frank Wolf, who led the first congressional delegation to war-torn Darfur, awakening the world to the reality of genocide in Sudan. Congressman Wolf will help bring perspective to the changes in Sudan and why we should take hope that it can happen elsewhere. We'll also be joined by Faith McDonald, who has been an advocate for the persecuted in Sudan for decades. And finally, Travis Weber and Ariel Del Turco will be in studio for a look at how these apostasy laws are being used in about a dozen and a half countries to restrict religious freedom and how we might encourage their repeal. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you miss anything on your way home, you can find it all later, right there. at TonyPerkins.com. Well, joining us now, former Congressman Frank Wolf from Virginia. He was the author of the 1998 U.S. International Religious Freedom Act, and he has worked for decades to advance religious freedom overseas, including in the country of Sudan. Congressman, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony. Good to be with you. And I want to thank you. I want to thank FRC. And I want to thank your supporters for the good work that you guys do. You really make a big difference.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And looking at Sudan and these recent developments with the repeal of the apostasy law, which has been used to suppress religious minorities, I mean, you were one of the first focused on this. You've been to Sudan multiple times. I mean, give us a sense of the development there. How significant is what we see happening in Sudan?
It is very, very significant. My first trip was in January of 1989. And of course, you know, over a million, some say 2 million people died in the North-South conflict. Don't forget, too, Tarabi, who was kind of a big operative in Sudan at that time, a cartoon, he invited bin Laden to live in Sudan. Osama bin Laden lived in Sudan for 5 years. Five years. And more people were killed in the North-South battle that area than killed in Bosnia, Somalia, Kosovo, and Rwanda combined. So it has been a dramatic, dramatic change. You've had terrorism. You've had ghost houses. The conditions in Khartoum were beyond imagination. And, of course, you know, the largest embassy, if you've been there, is the Chinese embassy. The Chinese were all over the place giving arms and aid and equipment. And so it's come from that situation until really, and I want to give a lot of credit to George W. Bush, President Bush, and also John Danforth, the special envoy. When President Bush appointed Danforth in 2001, the conditions were horrible. It was beyond imagination. Going to Khartoum was like going back 100 years, and Bashir was an evil person. As you know, Bashir became an indicted war criminal, and the UN wanted to take action, and many other countries did, and so many people died. And I think as a result of that, and you now have what they just did with regards to a blasphemy law, you have conditions changing, and you have a new country. You have the country of Southern Sudan. So it is just so unbelievable, the change, all for the good.
So, Congressman Wolf, how difficult was it to get policymakers to focus on Sudan and what was unfolding there?
Well, it was impossible. I mean, we went there in 89. I remember being in Kenya, and I said, I want to go in, and our embassy wouldn't let me go in. So I jumped on a private plane with a guy named Egil Hagen, who was a special forces for the Norwegian People's Aid. And people didn't want to go, didn't want you to be there. It was just a different, it was a lawless place. And Christians were being slaughtered. I mean, the number of people who died in battle, the number of people who died in hunger, the poverty, the no health care. And so nobody wanted to deal with it. I would go back and forth. As former Senator Humphrey from New Hampshire was very, very active. Congressman Payne, who since died, a Democrat from New Jersey, was very active. There was a handful that kind of stayed with it. But I really want to, again, John Danforth, who became the special envoy, was appointed by President Bush in 2001, a couple of days before 9/11. The work that the Bush administration did with John Danforth really turned everything. And I had the honor to be at the signing ceremony. Bashir was there. It was amazing. In 2005 in Kenya, where the South got its independence. So, but nobody wanted to talk about it. And the genocide, of course, as you know, in Darfur, genocide came about 300,000 people died. So it was a hard thing to get people to be interested in.
So now with this new transitional government, which was a combination of obviously international focus on Sudan, but you know, it was the people of Sudan that rose up and said enough is enough after three decades of Islamic government. Is this something we could see replicated elsewhere around the world?
Well, I think you could. I mean, believe me, nobody in 1985, when I went to Romania, thought that Ceausescu would fall when you'd have a democracy come in. And so the answer is yes, if you keep hitting it over and over and over and over. And this was a bipartisan issue. There were many Democrats, as I said, former Congressman Capuano from Massachusetts, Don Payne. And so, yes, you can. What happens is America gets very impatient. We just kind of move on to the next issue. But yes, if you stay with it and persist and also have the political leadership and also people like you, I mean, I know the work that you did with Amir Ibrahim, people in the outside groups that cared, then you can really make a difference. Sudan was almost the beginning of this whole, it's really where I kind of got a lot of interest in the area, international religious freedom. And then you had Chuck Colson, you had the Catholic Church, you had many other groups. So the answer is yes. If you stay with it, you can make a tremendous difference. But you need the political leadership to be in sync with what's taking place by the NGOs and groups like yours.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Congressman Frank Wolf, former congressman of Virginia, my guest. Congressman, you mentioned Miriam Ibrahim. You worked very closely with us to have hearings back when she was in prison to draw attention to her situation. But I remember after she was released, she was here in the United States, you and I were having a conversation, and you told me that we needed to make religious freedom, international religious freedom, a priority in the 2016 election, which we ultimately did. And as a result, I think we see this administration focusing very heavily on religious freedom. How important of a role has that played in changing the landscape globally?
Oh, big time. And again, you're right. The Trump administration on the issue of religious freedom, international religious freedom, has done a great job. There are no countries, and I know somebody will find where there's no country that I know where there's international, where there's domestic religious freedom, where people can worship and not worship, depending on whatever their own views are, that we are at war at, that we are in conflict with. You may remember the words that President Reagan said. He said the words in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were a covenant with the people, not only in Philadelphia in 1776 and 1787, but with the entire world. Wherever there is religious freedom, we are not at war with the people. Where there is not religious freedom, I mean, just look at, I mean, China, the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, the Falun Gong, the Buddhists,
right.
Uyghurs taken away in concentration camps. We're in conflict with them. So it is the fundamental core, and in many respects, for the longest period of time, I mean, the Clinton administration didn't think that we should make this a priority. They thought this was a mistake. You look at the speech that Madeleine Albright gave at Catholic University, where she opposed our bill. But where there's religious freedom, you generally are at peace.
Yeah, yeah. Congressman Frank Wolf, we're out of time. Obviously, I want to continue this conversation. We're going to have to do that on another occasion because I think there's some parallels with what's happening in Nigeria even now that you've brought attention to. And we'll save that conversation for another day. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. God bless you. Bye now.
Folks, don't go away. We're coming back with more of this special edition of Washington Watch right on the other side of the break.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
This is Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you happen to be on Twitter, it is at T Perkins or Parler at T Perkins. All right, continuing today, our focus on Sudan and the changes that have taken place. Here to talk more about the persecuted church in Sudan is Faith McDonald. She is the director of Religious Liberty Programs and of the Church Alliance for a New Sudan for the Institute of Religion and Democracy. She has been working for the persecuted church in Sudan and other African nations since 1993. She's been at this for a while. She has organized rallies and vigils for Sudan in front of the White House. In fact, she organized one for Miriam Ibrahim, who we're going to hear from a little bit later in the program. I participated in that. She's held rallies at the State Department, the Canadian Embassy, and the Sudanese Embassy. She's drafted legislation on religious persecution for the Episcopal Church and for the United States Congress. And she's been to Sudan. She's cultivated rich and strong relationships with believers there, and she joins us now. Faith, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. Great to be with you.
Well, Faith, let me just start with, you know, we're focusing on Sudan. After 3 decades mm-hmm. of being under an Islamic government, Islamist government, we're seeing rays of hope, the apostasy laws being repealed. What do you make of the developments in Sudan as it pertains to persecuted Christians?
Well, Tony, we thank God for every step in the right direction. And, you know, you and I both know that people have been praying about this for many years. So I'm happy about that. I'm always cautious. I remember a book by the former vice president of Sudan at a time when there was a peace before, a dear man, Abel Alir, who wrote a book called Sudan, Too Many Agreements Dishonored. So I always, you know, want to make sure that we don't get ahead of ourselves as in foreign policy as the U.S. government, thinking that everything is just peachy now and changing all of the things we put into place to keep Sudan from committing atrocities. I think the Christians in Sudan right now are very happy that things are changing, especially the end of the apostasy law, which is really remarkable, as well as the end of public flogging and of female genital mutilation. But they still have a ways to go. And I did hear one thing today which caused me some concern, was that with the aid for the virus, that there are Christians in Sudan who are being told that they have to convert to Islam before they get the food aid that is supposed to be going to everyone in Sudan. So I don't know if that's a local thing, and we're going to just have to start watching out for Sudan having local governments that don't
right.
like what the civilian government is doing, you know?
Yeah, there's no question that that is going to be a challenge. I mean, we see that in other countries. We see that, I've seen that in Egypt as we've, under el-Sisi, where they've tried to move to more, I would say, more religious freedom. But when you get to some of the remote parts of Egypt, the word hadn't quite gotten there yet. And I think Sudan, very fragile infrastructure. There's going to be some ongoing challenges. You're right to urge caution. But I think, Faith, from the standpoint of your advocacy and the work that you have done, you know, for decades, this has to be encouraging and should encourage others that, you know, if we do not lose heart, if we'll just continue, that we will reap if we don't lose heart.
Amen. Amen. It is. It's very encouraging. And frankly, I never expected to see this. You know, I didn't know what would ever happen. But when the people started to rise up, really, you know, and after many years of the other people, the marginalized people groups, the Nuba and the Darfurians and the Bija, trying to stand up for their rights and many people dying for those rights, then to be joined by the people in the center of the country with these protests, it was just, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So, we need to keep praying, though. I think that the civilian part of this government is great. Actually, the Minister of Justice, who made a lot of these changes, used to demonstrate on the streets of D.C. with me for Darfur. So we see that happening, and yet the military we have to watch out for, and I'm hoping that as the transition takes place that we can see an end to this dual kind of reign and have a complete civilian government.
Right.
And also, they need to watch out for some of the radical imams who are not happy with these changes.
Right.
I heard about one who self-exiled to Turkey, and I thought, well, he's in the right place now. So I'm sure President Erdogan loves him.
It is far from stable. In fact, was when I was in Sudan earlier this year, in fact, just a couple of weeks, about a week after I left, there was an attempt on the life of the prime minister whom we had been with, because there are some who are not happy about this. But Faith, before we run out of time in this segment, from a standpoint of the church in America, Christians, believers, our listeners, what should they and can they be doing right now, not only as it pertains to Sudan, but other places around the world where believers are being persecuted?
Oh, definitely. Pray. Get to know as much as they can. Yeah, another place where we really need the body of Christ to stand up for their brothers and sisters is Nigeria. The Christians in Nigeria are under what is really a genocidal attack. So people need to learn more. They need to pray. They need to speak out. We're really pushing because there are some narratives that say that the problem in Nigeria is just a clash between herdsmen and farmers.
Right.
But this is a deliberate attack on the Christians. And also to help support as much as they can. You know, like in Sudan, we have precious people in the Nuba Mountains who for years had to hide in caves from the bombings that were going on. Now that that's not happening, they can get back to life. But it would be great to have some support, especially when this virus pandemic is going
right,
on.
Right. Faith, thanks so much. We got to leave it there. We're up against a break. Mm-hmm. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Tony. God bless you.
All right. Folks, don't go away. Maryam Ibrahim, the Sudanese mother who was imprisoned in Sudan, joins us next. Don't go away.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has released a new 3-part series titled 3 Ways to Read the Bible. In this series, Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, shares helpful ways to be encouraged and directed by God's truth through studying and applying the Bible's text. Now's the time to get to know God through His Word by looking into the Bible and learning what it says about God, humanity, and the power of Scripture. During the season of isolation, devote time to the Lord and seek out His meaning for you. In times of crisis and any time, this blog series is a great primer on opening your eyes and heart to Him through His Word. Check out this helpful resource and learn how to read the Bible with not just your eyes, but your heart. To learn more, visit frcblog.com. That's frcblog.com.
This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, today, focused on the issue of Sudan, because it's important when you look at our foreign policy and what's happening under this administration in terms of prioritizing religious freedom, that it's having an effect. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the program, back in 2014, I became aware of a young Sudanese Christian mother who had been imprisoned along with her son. And at the time, she was 6 months pregnant. She was convicted of apostasy and sentenced to die. Well, because of some effective advocacy of men like Congressman Frank Wolf, you heard from earlier, and also former Congressman Mark Meadows, who's now the chief of staff to the president, who worked very closely with me on this case, Miriam was eventually freed, and she is now living in the United States, and she joins us by phone. Miriam, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. I really appreciate the effort you add in my case, and we are continuous working on that.
And I know you are an advocate now for others who are suffering a similar persecution that you did. But I want to ask you, Mary, when you look back and you saw just recently where Sudan repealed the apostasy law, the very law by which you were convicted and sentenced to die, are you encouraged by what you see happening in Sudan?
Yes, I see things going really well in a good direction. And but let me tell you this, son. I was convicted of apostasy, but, and this is good news to know that apostasy law has been abolished. But I've been on a Zoom meeting, discussion a couple of days ago with Nasreddin Bilbari, the Sudanese Minister of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions that have been asked, and this is related to my case, this is very important. People need to know this, and especially you, in the term of advocacy. One of the question is being asked, where is the woman from this, and where is, like, family law? This is one of the issues that we need to discuss, and we need to highlight these issues. And more, Sudan is moving forward with the legal reform and new laws and all this progress. So my case, I wasn't converted. I wasn't converted. My case related to family law was still going applied in Sudan. So the question for the Minister of Justice is, what is his opinion of marriage between Christian and Muslim? He said this is, will go back to religious leaders and the other members in the transitional government. He won't make a decision on that. This is what's my biggest concern. So for my case, yes, it is absolutely wonderful news to know that apostasy law has been abolished, but it's still the things that affected women and children, Christians,
right,
in Sudan.
Right, yeah.
It's a part of family law, you know.
A lot of work yet to be done.
But we are going in a good direction, and I really appreciate U.S. government, USF, EFOR, and State Department and Office of Religious Freedom on this. So we are going in a good direction right now. So I appreciate that.
So Mary, let me ask you this. How will the repeal of the apostasy law affect Christians in Sudan?
It is. Affect them in many ways, and affect especially the youth. And it's a part, as Secretary Pompeo always saying, the freedom of religious is a God-given right to people. You know, you take the right for who to worship and who to follow. You take everything from them. So this is good. And this is something really encouraging,
yes,
for me personally, for many Christian and many non-religious people in Sudan.
Right.
We have many people who don't have religious, like in many areas in Sudan. But, you know, Sudan is a country of many different cultures and
right,
language and religious. Yeah.
Let me ask you one final question before we run out of time. I was recently in Sudan. I went to the prison where you were being held in Khartoum. And when you were there in that prison, when you look back on that, are you amazed at what God did in your situation?
Yes, I am. I'm very grateful for that. And let me tell you something, I'm still working and I'm still in contact with many grassroots organizations and civil society leaders back in Sudan, even members of the guards in prison. Our organization is working, advocating and highlighting these issues. And we've been a part of all this protest change. I'm working here in close contact, including USAID, Mark Meadows, and Vancouver, all those. Like, I have a lot of support here, and I'm very grateful for that, including you, sir, also. So, but as I said, we still have to focus on family law issues. When
yes,
I mentioned to Muhammad, my lawyer, I said, well, this is really concerning. Like, if now my son Martin, who spent most of precious toddlerhood age in prison,
yeah,
he has to go back to Sudan and fall in love with Sudanese Muslim girl. And then get married. That means this girl, she will face the same thing I did face.
Yeah.
So his family, when we have new law, new constitution, we need to make sure this is no one left behind.
Right. We're moving in that direction. Mary, we got to leave it there. Out of time. Thank you for joining us. Great to talk with you, and we rejoice with you. Folks, don't go away. We're back with more after this.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increased pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/sexuality. Again, that's frc.org/sexuality.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
With horrifying acceleration in recent years, verified reports of murders, rapes, mutilations, and kidnapping of Christians in Nigeria have persistently increased. These attacks are frequently accompanied by the torching of homes, churches, villages, and agricultural fields. A July 15, 2020 headline reports that over 1,000 Nigerian Christians were killed in the first 6 months of 2020. This is in addition to 11,000 Christians who have been killed since June 2015. News stories about the assaults in Nigeria are rarely reported in mainstream media outlets. But when they are, they're regularly explained away as effects of climate change, local feuds, or religious wars for which both sides bear equal responsibility. For more information about the persecution of Christians in Nigeria, read FRC's publication, The Crisis of Christian Persecution in Nigeria, at frc.org/Nigeria.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you missed any of the previous interviews, you can catch it later at TonyPerkins.com. Everything's archived right there. All right, when we look at the issue of Sudan, as we were talking about with Miriam, you know, there's still issues. You've got the family law and how that's adjudicated, whether it's through Sharia. And so what actually, in my conversations with the prime minister and the transitional government there, they are in many ways trying to extricate the laws from the Islamic law. Now, this is a country that has had heavy Muslim influence for decades, and for the last three decades, it's been ruled by an Islamist government where Sharia law has been applied. Now, repealing the apostasy law is a major step in the right direction because you got to understand the use of the apostasy law, how governments use that to not only restrain religious freedom, suppress it, but also other freedoms as well. Now, joining me to talk about that is some of FRC's own experts on international religious freedom, Travis Weber. He is the FRC's Vice President for Policy and Government Affairs and the Director of our Center for Religious Liberty, and Ariel DiTurco, who is the Assistant Director of the Center for Religious Liberty here at the Family Research Council. Travis, Ariel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony.
Now, let's talk about first, you know, there are about a dozen and a half other countries that have apostasy laws in place. So let's just start with that. How are these apostasy laws used? What are they and how are they used?
Yeah, so Tony, these laws punish people who apostatize and convert away from Islam. Across much of the Muslim world, backed by social pressure, the governments use these to deter people from choosing their faith freely and will often be used to punish mere allegations of this crime. Mobs will be whipped up and take punishment into their own hands in some cases. In other cases, the government will actually enforce these and punish people and bring charges. The real threat here is against the freedom to choose one's own faith. And this is something that is inconsistent with how we understand religious freedom as Christians and in the United States. And thankfully, we have allies across the lines of some different faiths, as we've been hearing, to fight for religious freedom and the ability to choose one's faith. But it's important for us to understand, you know, we don't deal with these laws here in the U.S., but they're a major threat to religious freedom around the world.
So, Ariel, when you look at what's taken place in Sudan, where the repeal of the apostasy law, we've got, as I mentioned, about a dozen and a half other countries. What would it take to see other countries begin to move in a similar direction?
Well, as you know, Tony, this is a really rare and impressive move on behalf of Sudan. Sudan is the only Muslim-majority country to repeal an apostasy or blasphemy law within the last 2 years. And for years, Sudan has topped a list of the world's worst violators of religious freedom. So this is a really encouraging move. It should be encouraging to us as international religious freedom advocates that countries can change, that this is a huge monumental step for Sudan, and this can happen in other countries where these laws are posing a threat to religious liberty.
You know, Travis, I mentioned at the top of the program, in fact, Congressman Wolf and I were discussing it briefly, how when you look at countries that have religious freedom, they have other freedoms, including economic freedoms. And given the situation in Sudan where, you know, they continue to be kind of on the bubble economically, that if you begin to see greater freedom and economic prosperity, that actually can help other countries take note of this and say, you know what, hey, if religious freedom does lead to these other freedoms and greater prosperity and greater stability, maybe it's something we should think about.
It is. This is an undertold story, the link between religious freedom and economic growth and national security. We've done some work on this. There's some scholars who've looked at this issue. There's been a linkage that has been noted, as Mr. Wolf pointed out, between countries that are free and their support for religious liberty and their refusal to go to war with one another, the promotion of peace and lack of armed conflict. So this is an argument that needs to be spread around the world, you know, going to the point of apostasy laws that we are discussing here. As Ariel noted, Sudan has repealed it. That's an encouraging sign. It can be an encouragement to other regimes that have these laws in place. Iran uses these laws and the threats behind the ideology of the law to deter conversions and deter those freely choosing their faith. They see it as a national security threat, but this only fuels instability, violence, and the type of tenuous potential conflicts that we've alluded to. And so I'm encouraged by Sudan's move. I think, you know, we should be utilizing these developments to encourage other nations to follow suit. Ariel's been leading our reassessment of the research we have in this paper and our report on apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws. And we hope to have that finalized soon to be able to have a new updated lay of the landscape of where these laws are in place to show positive trends that have taken place and encourage other nations to follow likewise.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. Glad to have you with us. My guest in this final segment, Travis Weber, Vice President of Policy and Government Affairs here at the Family Research Council, and Ariel Del Turco, who is the Assistant Director of the Center for Religious Liberty here at the Family Research Council. What next steps does Sudan need to take as it pertains to bolstering religious freedom in that country for all Sudanese?
Tony, I think, you know, obviously the repeal of the law is significant, but the law and the tools the government may use are only one part of this. As we've noted, there can be cultural hostility to religious freedom. We see that at home, and we see it around the world too. Significant ways, threats to life and limb in Pakistan, elsewhere around the world. The Sudanese authorities should be encouraged to continue to promote the ideal of religious freedom and understanding of religious freedom in civil society, train the power holders in the culture, the institutions, educators, lawyers, government officials on how to think about religious freedom and how to promote and how to entrench it. So Sudan has a backstop and a bulwark for religious freedom, prevents any sliding back in the years ahead.
So when we look at these other countries, as I mentioned, I think there's 17 other countries that have apostasy laws. Of course, you mentioned Iran. But are there any that we might see some promising developments taking place right now that would suggest that, A, either the people, like they did in Sudan, you know, rise up against an Islamist regime, or B, that we just see natural forces taking place where there may be some changes afoot when it comes to religious freedom in those countries?
Tony, I think, you know, the lay of the land, unfortunately, is rather dim in many of these countries. I'm looking at our list of countries with apostasy laws right now. I do think, you know, Egypt, there are actors who want to promote religious freedom. There are other actors who do not want to promote religious freedom. So we just need to encourage the allies we have there on religious freedom to continue to promote it. Iraq has such a law. Obviously, Iraq has seen a lot of turmoil. There could be opportunity, though, to emerge from that turmoil with a positive religious freedom development. And I think also in Jordan, Kuwait, and the UAE, United Arab Emirates, those are countries which we could see positive movement on. The UAE has taken some positive steps on religious freedom. We'll have to wait and see, though, in the years ahead.
I mean, basically, the way the apostasy laws are utilized is primarily to keep people from changing their faith, which is a part of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And when it comes to religious freedom, it's the ability to not only have a faith, but to change your faith or to have no faith at all. And that is where these are being utilized. In fact, Miriam made reference to this. You know, she didn't switch her faith. She was a Christian. She was born a Christian. But they accused her of changing her faith from Islam to Christianity, and therefore she was charged with and convicted of apostasy. So it's really it keeps people from converting from being Muslim to Christian in most of these 17 countries.
That's absolutely right. You know, and that's one obstacle to the principle of religious freedom, which we hold to, which is the ability to choose one's faith and live out one's faith fully. The choose implies the ability to change one's faith. If you can't change it, then you're not free to choose it. And, you know, you must therefore be able to live it out in the public square and freely sharing it, speaking about it. In many of these countries, there's an interesting dynamic which we in the United States do not have so much, and that is an acceptance of some elements of different faiths, for instance, Christianity, as long as those faiths do not outwardly express themselves in a sharing and an evangelizing manner that would result in conversions possibly from Islam or any other faith. I mean, the principle is freedom to choose as you see fit. So I think you've put your finger on the issue here. Because of our principles on religious freedom, we see the apostasy laws as an obstacle to this, along with other obstacles, blasphemy laws, anti-conversion laws, which we have focused on in our publication and forthcoming research as well. And so, you know, these are issues that we here in the United States need to continue to point out and advocate in order to have freedom of religion for all around the world.
Let's we just got a few minutes left, and I want to address a couple of issues before we run out of time, one being I kind of addressed this at the top of the program, but I want to again focus on it for just a moment, and that is the issue of why should we be concerned about this? Why, as Christians in America, should we really care about spending our time, our energy, and our resources in promoting religious freedom in places like Africa and the Middle East?
Well, Tony, our Christian faith compels us to care for the religious freedom of other groups, and especially for Christians as well. God gives us the choice to follow him, and because of that, we are supposed to support that choice for everyone else. And as you were talking about with Frank Wolf at the beginning of the program, there are practical benefits to promoting religious freedom abroad as well. No country both respects religious freedom and poses a national security threat to the United States right now. And Frank Wolf touched on economics as well. It's the same conditions that are required for religious freedom, limited government, rule of law, freedom of association. These things are also required to promote economic growth as well. So these things go hand in hand, and there are a lot of benefits for the U.S. investing in promoting international religious freedom in our foreign policy.
So that leads to my next question is, okay, so there's a rationale, there's a reason that we should be concerned and we should care about this issue. But then what can we do? What can churches do? What can individual Christians do as they become more aware of the importance of this and the conditions around the world?
Tony, I think the key there is for those here to be informed first, and that information leading to prayer for religious freedom and for the persecuted, and that being followed by government engagement. When our elected leaders know that we care about religious freedom and that's the issue on our minds, that's the issue on which we're going to make decisions in the voting booth, that's the issue then that elected leaders are going to pay attention to and make sure is addressed. So we have that freedom here to act on what we believe, live out our faith as it concerns our political activism on religious freedom. I think, you know, that's a chore and a task for all Americans, but it's a noble one because we naturally want to help those who cannot help themselves, who are in need of a hand, in need of a lift up from being lifted up from their oppression and their situations around the world where they, you know, governments have their feet, the feet of the government on the necks of the religiously persecuted around the world. And it's our noble chore and noble task to be able to come to their aid.
And there are tangible outcomes as Christians pray, as Christians advocate, as we saw in the case of Maryam Ebrahim, who was on the program earlier. Had it not been for the intense focus of Christians and churches, and of course I could also throw in Pastor Andrew Brunson. Another example of that, as Christians and churches focused, they prayed, they advocated, the government took action. And so it clearly makes a difference in the lives of those individuals who are being persecuted, imprisoned, but it also has an effect globally as the world takes note that America has placed a high priority on religious freedom.
Tony, it absolutely does. You mentioned the case of Pastor Andrew Brunson. That was resolved due to attention on the situation, much prayer, prolonged attention, practical steps taken to help him, but ultimately due to actions taken by the Trump administration to sanction high-level Turkish officials under a Treasury Department executive authority that was proceeding on the authority of the Global Magnitsky Act, a statute that Congress had passed, that sanction put the hurt on Turkey, and they wanted to get out from under it.
Yeah.
And ultimately led to the release of Pastor Brunson. This is the kind of sustained action we need on these cases around the world.
Well, Travis, Ariel, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.